Nova epizoda podcasta novog magazina Razumeti čelično prijateljstvo je pred vama. Najpre želim da iskoristim priliku i zahvalim se Američkoj ambasadi na podršci u produkciji ovog podcasta, a pred vama je nešto drugačija epizoda. Razgovarali smo sa nekim ko nije iz Srbije, nije čak ni iz regiona Zapadnog Balkana. Razgovarali smo sa Davidom Šumanom iz Atlantskog saveta, dakle, organizacije koja ima svoje sedište u Sjedinjenim Američkim Državama. I povod je upravo bila jedna konverzacija koju smo vodili o politici koju Sjedinjene Američke Države vode prema Narodnoj Republici Kini, ali naravno da smo kroz razgovor temu približili i našem regionu i poziciji koje Sjedinjene Američke Države imaju prema saradnji koju Srbija, dakle, razvija sa Narodnom Republikom Kinom. Mislim da ćete saznati onako jedne vrlo zanimljive stvari o osnovama odnosa Sjedinjenih Američkih Država i Narodne Republike Kine, ali i da ćete imati priliku da čujete kako neko ko sedi u Vašingtonu vidi poziciju Srbije u ovom trouglu. Takođe, kao i uvek, zapratite nas na YouTube kanalu NM Novi Magazin. Mi tu izbacujemo nove epizode na svake dve nedelje. Pored toga, možete nas pratiti na Instagramu, na Facebooku, na TikToku, a možete nas slušati u audio verziji na svim relevantnim podcast platformama Spotify, Deezer, Apple Podcast. Uživajte u epizodi, mislim da će vam biti zaista zanimljiva. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Understanding the Steel Friendship podcast. This is another episode in the series of the podcast dedicated to the better understanding of the partnership between Serbia and China. But like many aspects of international relations, this is something that we cannot look outside of the broader picture and the broader context of the geopolitical developments, competition of great powers and great forces. And I am very honored and happy to greet today someone who I actually had the pleasure to meet a couple of years ago, I would not say many years ago, but a couple of years ago in a little bit different capacity. With me is Dr. David Shulman. He is a senior director of the Global China Hub at the Atlantic Council, a US-based think tank, US-based organization dealing with various topics, but he is the one who is very dedicated and I would even dare to say in charge of forming an approach of this organization towards the China topic and general relationship that the China has with many countries on a global scale, but certainly focusing on the US-China relationship. And without further ado, David, welcome to our podcast. It's very nice to have you today here with us.
Thank you, Stefan. It's great to be with you.
David, as I mentioned, we had a chance to meet a couple of years ago, but from there, it is being well known that things have changed a little bit when it comes to the Chinese position on the global scale, and it is certainly a sort of transformation of relationship between US and China. I would certainly start our discussion with a very simple question of how do you currently see the state of relationship between US and China? And how would you define the main topics or the main aspects of the Sino-US cooperation or the Sino-US relationship today?
Well, it's a great question, and I think, as you said, we've seen quite a shift in kind of interesting changing dynamics in the U.S.-China relationship over the last year, and it's good timing to be having this conversation. We just had a phone call between President Biden and President Xi this week. Secretary of Treasury Yellen is currently on her way, or has already arrived in China. And this follows, of course, some meetings that have happened between the United States and China in the last few months. National Security Advisor Sullivan and Foreign Minister Wang Yi meeting in Bangkok earlier this year, and then Secretary of State Blinken meeting with Wang Yi again in Munich in February, following the meeting that they had, Xi and Biden, in the United States, in California, last November, which really kind of was a key moment where the two sides decided to really make an effort to stabilize the relationship after a fairly rocky year in U.S.-China relations, which, as many of your audience members will remember, was kicked off by this incident where there was a arguably a spy balloon flying over the United States from China that kind of set the relationship off course for much of last year. And so what we've seen now is this effort to restabilize things. We've seen an effort to come out with more agreements in key areas, including around counter-narcotics, fentanyl, and it's a big concern for the United States, China's role in terms of precursor chemicals for fentanyl in the United States, potential progress on discussions around artificial intelligence, and also getting back on the same page in terms of military-to-military communications, which is really critical to ensuring that this competition that will remain and is intensifying, and I'll get to that in a second, does not veer into conflict. So that's all to the good. And this conversation that Xi and Biden had, by all reports from both sides, did touch on those topics. In the military-to-military space, we know that Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is probably going to talk to his counterpart next month or in the coming month. We have follow-on meetings, not just Yellen today in China, but also Secretary Blinken probably planning to go. So there's a lot that points to positive indications of really both sides trying to maintain that spirit out of the California meeting to try to ensure that there's greater stability in the relationship. But that all said, the structural factors that have caused there to be intensifying competition between Washington and Beijing remain. Those have not changed. And if anything, the elements of the relationship that are competitive have only continued apace, even as there's been this effort to stabilize the relationship. So in the Taiwan space, the United States, President Biden has made an effort to underscore the U.S. position on Taiwan has not changed and that the U.S. does not support Taiwan independence, et cetera. But we see China stepping up its efforts in the Taiwan Strait in terms of gray zone activities. Even the day after, I believe, the phone call, we had a large number of Chinese ships and planes in Taiwan's air defense identification zone. So that issue is not going away in terms of intensity. We have the new president-elect Lai in Taiwan being inaugurated in May. And so everyone's kind of watching to see what that means in terms of a rise again in tension over Taiwan. Technology issues are front and foremost and a very big concern for China. Xi Jinping in the call that they just had, again, mentioned just after the Taiwan issue, China always mentions the Taiwan issue as a point of contention, but then right after that mentioned US efforts to restrict trade and tech, especially in emerging and critical technology, which from the United States perspective is essential to ensuring that we are not giving China the tools to improve China's military capabilities and risk US national security. So that continues apace and will remain a key point of difference in the relationship. Secretary Yellen is going to be talking about Chinese overcapacity in a bunch of different industries and how that's affecting US manufacturing, also European manufacturing, which is something that the US and the EU share in terms of concerns about what China's doing in terms of subsidies, especially in clean energy. The US and also, of course, the Europeans concerned about China's ongoing support for Russia in its war against Ukraine and efforts to basically help Russia to reestablish its defense production capabilities, even if China is not providing lethal aid to Russia. And then there's ongoing issues around China's growing aggression in the region, in the Indo-Pacific, beyond Taiwan, particularly right now in the South China Sea around the Philippines, as the Philippines continue to try to resupply a rotting ship on a disputed shoal in the middle of the South China Sea. So these issues continue. And there's a fundamental belief, I think, on both sides that this competition is long term and it's structural. It's not going to change. But at the same time, both sides, I think, for good reasons, are trying to ensure that this intense competition, as the U.S. administration puts it, does not veer into conflict, which, of course, would be bad for the United States, would be bad for China, and would be bad for the world.
Thank you for painting that picture, and I really appreciate that you have introduced several third actors definitely in the conversation about the current state of relationship between US and China. And if I may say, from outside perspective, it looked for a long period of time that for the US, when it comes to the foreign policy, the main focus of the foreign policy will actually be in the Pacific region. And talking about Pacific region, Taiwan and Taiwan Strait always pops out as a potential point of further escalation of let's say, not conflict, but definitely competition between US and China. With the outbreak of the Russian aggression in 2022, for a short period of time, or maybe not that short period of time, the focus, and I would again dare to say, completely, you know, moved to that part of the world. But now we slowly have again refocusing on Pacific and on the question of Taiwan. Serbian, for example, position on Taiwan is much closer to the one of Beijing than the one of DC, probably. But could you go a little bit more into the depth on what is the DC's position on Taiwan currently? We can talk a little bit, of course, about the potential support when it comes to the defense coming from US to Taiwan, but also the formal support of one China policy on another side. Could you explain a little bit more to our audience what is position of US on this issue and on this question?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's so fundamental to so much that's going on in the U.S.-China relationship, and for good reason. It's a great focus around the world in terms of where this question is going, because everyone is aware of the real risks of potentially conflict, and if not conflict, crisis that could have a major impact on supply chains through East Asia, on especially high technology supply chains, and we all know that Taiwan is essential, especially for semiconductors. So the risks to the global economy are great. And then, of course, the potential for risks of actual kinetic conflict, a big concern for everyone. The United States position has long been, and this is based upon the Taiwan Relations Act, as well as communiques that were put in place with China decades ago, that the United States does recognize the One China, what we call the One China policy. But the United States is dedicated to supporting Taiwan's ability to defend itself, right? And so the Chinese line on this has been that the United States and Taiwan are fundamentally the ones that are changing the status quo in the Taiwan Strait, changing the understanding about the United States not supporting Taiwan independence, the United States supporting, as I said, not trying to help Taiwan to militarily go independent and raise tensions in the Taiwan Strait. But what China has been fundamentally doing over the last many years now has been increasing its coercion of Taiwan, both militarily, diplomatically, economically, and also in terms of disinformation efforts and interference in Taiwan itself. In ways that really undermine, or at least are an attempt to undermine Taiwan's democracy and really divide Taiwan society. And so the United States, I think, are, I won't speak for the Biden administration, but I think that the policy is to really step up efforts to ensure that Taiwan truly is able to defend itself and can keep up with what China has been doing in terms of its buildup militarily across the strait, which has been well documented, and so that Taiwan is not in a situation where it will be overwhelmed potentially in a conflict. Obviously, we've seen there's been lots of reporting on U.S. Support, both in terms of arms sales to Taiwan, training militarily of Taiwan, with an effort to ensure that Taiwan, there's often a phrase that's thrown around, that the porcupine strategy, that Taiwan is able to defend itself in the event of an invasion by the People's Republic of China, that Taiwan could hold off the invasion for long enough, and then potentially, and again, this is a key part of U.S. policy, potentially the United States could intervene in Taiwan's defense, But that strategic ambiguity policy, as it's called, where the US does not clearly state whether or not it would necessarily get involved in a conflict, remains. There's been some confusion, perhaps, over that point over the last few years. President Biden has made some comments that muddied the waters a little bit. But the United States has reaffirmed that it's not a set policy that the United States will get involved in a conflict over the Taiwan Strait, and that ambiguity policy has long been in place. And part of the effort there is to also ensure that there's not an encouragement of Taiwan to declare independence, and that part of the strategic ambiguity policy has kind of been forgotten over the years. So I'll just close by saying, there's been, I think, some concern as we've moved from President Tsai, who is, is now term limited, and now William Lai has been elected in elections that were held in January. As I mentioned earlier, he'll be inaugurated in May. Lai has been someone who has been even more outspoken than most folks in the DPP party, which is the party that is more pro-independence than the Kuomintang party, the KMT party. And so there has been some concern, especially on the Chinese side, the PRC side, that when Lai comes into office, he will make a strong effort to actually formally declare independence or do other things that China almost certainly would have to respond to with strong measures. That's, I think, a concern on the US side as well. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think thus far, what we've seen is measured comments from Mr. Lai. So I think everyone's waiting to see what he says in his May inauguration speech. And as I mentioned earlier, that will kind of be the next moment everyone's watching to see if tensions over Taiwan rise again.
Thank you for that very comprehensive and informative response. Again, looking from the outside perspective, it looks that US really tries hard not to cross any lines that would shift the discussion towards the potential conflict either between Taiwan and mainland China or between US and China on the other side. And even when some statements are potentially misinterpreted, there is always a very, very quick response to those statements made by the US officials. So the policy has been continuous, and it looks like that the status quo is something, again, from the outside perspective, the status quo is something that is at this point the most sustainable one. Speaking about status quo and speaking about potential conflicts, there are ongoing conflicts in other parts of the world. And since the beginning of 2022, the eyes of the world have been pointed towards Ukraine. You mentioned briefly in your introductory remarks that there is some division or different positions between US and China on the Russian role in the Ukrainian aggression, which obviously is not that small of a division. Could you give a comment on how do you perceive the Chinese position from your perspective, of course, or maybe to bring a little bit closer the US perspective on Chinese role in the Russian aggression in Ukraine?
Well, to start with, I think it's important to underscore how important Russia is to China. And I think that, at this moment in time, over 2 years into Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and this war, which has shown Russia to not be perhaps quite as strong as militarily as folks might have thought, I think it's important to underscore that despite that, for China, Russia is its most important strategic partner. And so when we think about, why does China support Russia in its war against Ukraine, it's really important to underscore that in this protracted competition that China finds itself in with the United States, Russia remains critical both as a military partner, as a, of course, nuclear superpower, as a country with which it shares a 4,000-kilometer border, and obviously instability in Russia would be unimaginable for China, the potential impact in China, the fall of the Putin regime. None of that is something that China wants to see. And Russia, again, a key source of energy and food, potentially across that border in the event of a Taiwan Strait crisis, where China fears that the United States and others might cut off some key necessary inputs. So I could go on and on, but Russia is a really important partner for China, and that's how Xi Jinping views it. And so despite the fact that clearly China's support for Russia, even short of lethal aid, but all of the things we know we've seen in terms of support for dual use equipment for Russia's military effort, as I mentioned, continued energy buys that continue to prop up the Russian economy. All of these things are really necessary for China to do, even though there's really been a hit for China, as your audience will probably know, in terms of the European view in particular of China as a result of its support for Russia in this war. So that, I think, is kind of central. And then we can look at what China's doing in terms of its efforts, and these have been renewed recently with new diplomatic envoys to the region, Li Hui, the Eurasia envoy, traveling around Europe, as well as Wang Yi himself, trying to characterize China's role in this conflict as one of a potential mediator, as a country that wants to support stability and achieve peace. But in reality, everything that we've seen in terms of China's actions have been to fundamentally support Russia in its efforts. So I think, you know, that is the key element to understanding this. And I think we will continue to see China try to portray itself as a positive player in this, but without a willingness to encourage Russia to make any kind of actual concessions on the ground. And I think just trying to basically play both sides and support its most important partner, while at the same time trying to ensure that this does not result in significant long-term diplomatic damage for China. And then the other thing to mention is China, of course, portraying this along with Russia in the global south as a war that is has been initiated and then continued by the United States, by NATO, and really trying to put the blame on the West and not on Russia for, of course, having started the war in the first place.
Yeah, and it is something that has been very influential to the whole global community, but definitely Europe has been the one, you know, facing a little bit more challenges that have came out of the Russian aggression in Ukraine, and therefore the partnership between transatlantic partners, between US and Europe, has played a very important role in sustaining Ukraine's position during the Russian aggression. And it is often said that we see a difference between Western liberal democracies and the coalition between authoritarian regimes. That is the term that has often been used to describe the current political system, both within Russia, but also within China. But it looks that even though there is a much closer partnership between US and the European Union than let me say, like was a couple of years ago, there is a difference in approach that EU takes towards China currently than the ones that US takes. And often two terms that have been used to describe that for US has been decoupling, and for European Union it was de-risking. Could you maybe reflect on difference between de-risking and decoupling, or maybe to be more precise, because you are coming from US, do you see decoupling policy and decoupling approach as something that is sustainable, or do you see something that is a transformative depending on the state of relations between US and China, which is of course a thing that changes through time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I, you know, we're at this moment now where we're, I think, a year out or a little more than a year out from EU Commission President von der Leyen's speech on de-risking, which really was a key moment, I think, for the EU, for Europe, in terms of how to characterize economic dependencies on China and the risks that brought, certainly in the light of what had happened with Russia, obviously, and the need for Europe to wean itself off of dependence on Russian energy. I would say, for the United States, there's actually long been a kind of discomfort with the term decoupling because it sounds so drastic, and no one, well, almost no one in Washington genuinely believes that we're going to entirely decouple the US economy from China's. That's just not realistic. The trading relationship is deep. It hit record level last year. And so that's only going to continue, especially in obvious areas such as agricultural trade and other things such as this. So I think actually you've seen the administration and many people in Washington pick up the terminology of de-risking as one that is quite useful and perhaps a better description of what the United States is trying to do in terms of investment screening in terms of imports, but also outbound investment restrictions and screening, de-risking in terms of, as we've already mentioned, technology and the risks of high technology going to China that might raise national security risks. Again, similarities with what's happening in Europe, and there's been a lot of conversation between the U.S. and the EU, including this week, I believe, in the grouping called the Trade Technology Council, where they've been talking about ways to get on the same page around some of these economic security measures as well as technology measures. I know the U.S. has been encouraging countries such as Netherlands and companies like ASML to not be continuing to service Chinese companies and equipment in high technology areas around semiconductors because ASML has this special high-tech lithography equipment. So there's all of these conversations happening about how to get on the same page around de-risking. And I think it's very important for the United States and Europe to be on the same page. We're never going to get entirely aligned on our policies. But China's strategy is to create wedges between the U.S. and Europe, certainly in the transatlantic alliance generally, but also within Europe, right? And to try to use the natural differences that occur between member states in the EU, and also to use the draw of its market, which we all know China's economy is struggling, but China's market continues to be a big draw, especially for instance, German automakers. So China is trying to use those divisions within the EU, use those divisions within the transatlantic relationship to try to ensure that there's not a more united approach, and then China could take advantage of those loopholes and get the technologies that it needs in order to further its economy, which, as I mentioned, really top level concern now being shown by the Chinese government about U.S. measures, but I think also growing concern about whether the Europe's de-risking measures, Europe's economic security measures, which we've seen the package that the EU put out in terms of economic security measures going forward, especially on outbound investment restrictions. So I think China is concerned, but they are confident that those differences and the lure of China's market will ultimately win the day.
It is very, very interesting that you have mentioned very specific policies that have been adopted or implemented by the European Union, coming from Serbia and coming from the Western Balkans. For us, that is something that we will get to that. As candidate countries, at some point, things that now that you are mentioning now sound like a distant future for us. But we will have to deal with those topics, and we will have to deal with these things. I know that in some of your previous postings, you have spent much more time in the Western Balkans that you are spending it today, and that you have a time that you have time to follow the developments in the Western Balkans today. But it doesn't need to be mentioned that within the Western Balkans region, Serbia has been an outlier when it comes to the partnership with China. And the name of this podcast, actually, Steel Friendship, reflects the phrase that often is being used by the officials from Serbia and China to describe the level of relationship, the level of partnership between these two countries. This year, we have announcements, still not the exact dates, but we have announcement that the Chinese leader Xi Jinping could come to the or will come to the to Serbia to the official visit. So I am putting you on the spot a little bit, but because you are not closely following this as you had in the past, but I know that you do have some perspectives and some information. How do you see the current state of relationship between China and Serbia, and could you maybe give just a personal perspective on for Serbia as a country, what it could possibly mean for potential partnership with US, the fact that we have as developed partnership with China today?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think you mentioned the plan to visit, it seems, by Xi Jinping to Serbia, in addition to, I believe he's also going to go to France, and then I think also to Hungary, which is interesting because Hungary also, you know, a country that has had uniquely close ties with China as an EU member. And I think, you know, it goes to, as you were saying, this notion of the steel friendship. We've seen, you know, over the last several years, clearly close ties and engagement between President Vucic and President Xi. There's been a lot of efforts to try to, you know, have Belt and Road Initiative projects kind of follow through in Serbia and in the Balkans. Generally, you will know better than I that many of those have not progressed very quickly, but there seems to be a reinvigoration attempt from China, and maybe I would assume also from the Serbian side, in terms of, I think we had a free trade agreement, if I'm not mistaken, signed
yes,
at the end of last year. We also have, it looks like to me, a renewed effort to actually make real progress on the Belgrade to Budapest railway. And so I think some of those big projects that have been long discussed looks like they're going to make progress. As is mentioned, you know, the steel friendship, this notion of kind of collaboration on that kind of mining work. But there's also been more talk of China getting more involved in green energy projects in Serbia, right? And this is something that is consistent with the way that China's approaching a lot of its engagement economically around the world now, kind of transitioning into more in the green energy space. So I think we should expect to see a lot more in terms of China's push to engage in Serbia. China recognizes that Serbia is the big player in the Western Balkans, recognizes the strategic importance in terms of, you know, trade routes, you know, from Piraeus in Greece up to, you know, the EU market, recognizes also, as you mentioned, Serbia as an EU accession candidate country. And so how important, you know, that kind of relationship can remain and can continue to be for China. So I expect, and this visit is clear evidence of it, continued attention to the relationship in Belgrade. And then I think the question for Brussels and for the United States and for others is how to ensure, you know, real competition and offering to Serbia the type of investment and engagement that maybe can, I think counter is the wrong word, but can ensure that the China relationship with Serbia does not get to such a level that it in some way distracts from Serbia engaging with Europe, engaging with the United States, and continuing down that path towards accession. But as you mentioned, I'm not quite as current as I once was, so I hope I didn't get anything wrong, and I'd be curious if you had any thoughts.
No, I think that you have covered all the bases that are, especially from the perspective of someone who is watching this from outside, relevant. It is something that we are witnessing today, I would say a new phase of partnership where soft power of China has become increasingly important aspect of it. The Xi Jinping visit will probably be a highlight of that new development, and what is to be closely followed is the rhetorics, but also the further deepening of cooperation in specific areas. You know, when we are talking about Taiwan or Washington or even the European Union, we are talking about semiconductors and things that are, for Serbian perspective, still a little bit, you know, further from present day. But when it comes to the economic development, when it comes to the infrastructural development, when it comes to the technology in Serbia, either in the telecommunication or even in the defense industry, it is something that we are slowly witnessing when it comes to the upgrade of the current state of relationship with China. And FTA definitely is a premise for all of that. I would say that the FTA has probably been the most important agreement signed between two sides, and not on the sole purpose of, you know, extending the level of import or export, but also in creating a context in which development in other areas of cooperation is possible. So it includes also the defense sector as a possibility to purchase weaponry from China or to sell weaponry from Serbia to, you know, China as a partner, which for a country that has a candidate status for the European Union membership and also has very close cooperation with DC can be a controversial thing. So it is, you know, upon us to follow, and I hope that that it will remain, you know, of an interest of relevant researchers and organizations like you and Atlantic Council definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that security element is one that I have tracked in the past, and it's good that you mentioned it. I think certainly that is something that's high on the list of things that Washington is watching, both in terms of sales and equipment, trainings. We know there was police training in the past, these kinds of things, and what that could lead to in terms of a deepening security relationship. And of course, as you mentioned, the telecommunications relationship, everyone, watching what that means and whether China's relationship with Serbia, you know, on the whole does exacerbate some concerns about democratic institutions in the country. I think that's also a big concern that the U.S. and Brussels are watching as well.
Yeah, David, before letting you go, let me say just one more thing, and it is a little bit on a personal note. I believe that it was either late 2018 or early 2019 when we met for the first time, and you were with a different organization at that time. You came to Serbia to one of the visits in the region, and for me, actually, that was one of the first time when I had a chance to discuss this topic with someone who, you know, comes from abroad, from DC, and to talk about the cooperation between Serbia and China at that point in time. And after you, many came, because I would say that you and your colleagues at the time recognized the importance of the topic before everyone else. And I would even say that you are hipsters in that sense, that, you know, you dealt with China in the Western Balkans before it was cool. You see, now we have podcast about it. So thank you for being such an integral part of our podcast series. Thank you for bringing to our audience a little bit closer the way how the U.S. positions itself towards China, but also how that interconnections on the global scale are affecting, you know, the U.S. position on it. And hopefully in this in a couple of months we will have Xi Jinping, hopefully even before or after that we will be able to host you once again in Serbia as well.
I would love that. Thank you so much again. It's been a pleasure for me over the last, I guess you said, 6 years or so, getting to know you and benefiting, as I have, from your expertise on the Western Balkans and on China's engagement. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and chat with you today, and would love to do so again soon in the coming months after this visit.
Until next time, David, I wish you the pleasant rest of the day. And once again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.